Good evening, everyone. Thanks for taking the time, making the effort to come out tonight at the tail end of Snowmageddon, or as one of my friends coined it, Blizzilla. hopefully I haven't jinxed it. But I appreciate you being here, and glad to make it here myself. So you may have noticed lately that vowing is in the air and on our lips, as there's a precept study going on, happening down with Wet Mountain Sangha. And so there's that energy that we're taking up from periodically there formally, but there's that energy just flowing throughout me, at least. And I think Sarah's speaking of it as well, is looking at vowing and what does it mean to vow? And really part of the process, whenever we take up the precepts, is we ask that question, what might be the one vow? With the various manifestations we receive from the ancestors written out, but also the ones that we find making in our own lives, what might be the one vow that is the source of them all or running through them all? And it could be that it's an individual vow that you find at the source that goes on for some time, but maybe it feels complete at some time, then you discover a new one waiting to be born. Or maybe there's a universal quality to the vow you discover that is always there, endlessly, regardless of the various manifestations there that anyone might connect with. So along with contemplating that and being in that energy, this has been that time of year where I do a few speaking engagements out in the public in a short amount of time, which is a great opportunity for me to take up the question I'm always taking up, but this gives me a deadline to say something about it, of what are we up to here? What is it that we are doing? What is it that the practice is about? How am I seeing that? And what distilled from that questioning at this moment is along the lines of we are on one side of this coin of practice, we're endeavoring to uncover the generosity and wisdom, compassion, and skillful action that's inherent within us, within existence itself, so that we can bring it out into the world. And that connects with that vow, or vowing, is how am I going to bring these inherent qualities of existence, how am I going to manifest them and bring them out into the world? And on the other side of that coin of practice, I see that we are discovering the obstacles and hindrances that keep us from being able to realize that wisdom, compassion, generosity. And we spend time looking at those and letting them fall apart and putting them back together and maybe disappearing. So that's what I saw as a twofold process happening now. And so I began to get curious, just looking more at those hindrances and obstacles, and how many of them there seem to be. And last week, as carrying that energy around as well, I was leading the discussion downstairs from Asekiyazen Gates and touched into something in the reading that just lit up for me to saying, oh, look at that. That one thing seems to be pretty present in all those obstacles and hindrances. And I'll bring that in a little bit, but in more general terms, I began to see, what if there's one root delusion. And all the obstacles and hindrances and barriers, however they manifest for us, whether they're habits, emotions, afflictive emotions, as they're called sometimes, however we see them, however they manifest for us, what if there's only one delusion that informs them all, gives them life, and you can find it woven through them all? So I guess what I'm proposing tonight is that there is only one delusion. Inviting you to look at this for yourself and see what you find, and keeping looking at it myself as well. But the one delusion that I'm connecting with is something we bring in pretty regularly, and that shows how pervasive it is that regardless of what we're experiencing, whether it's positive or negative by our judgments, that we have this belief or stance or relationship to things that says, this isn't it. Yeah? This isn't it. And like I said, it has many manifestations, so I've made a list of some of the ones that... before I get to the list, what I was noticing about that, the it, we can reverse it. This isn't it, or it isn't this, means the same thing. And sometimes we can have an idea of what it is, and that can really feed that delusion. Because then the more ideas we have of what it is, the more we're able to see what isn't it, right? But that's not really a prerequisite for that belief or that relationship to things. Because whether you show up with an idea of what it is or not, you can still sense that in your own experience. I know over the course of time and your practice, I found and others find that maybe they do have an idea of what it is, but that begins to get taken apart and disappear, and you have less and less of an idea of what it might be. But there's still that sense of, it's not this though. Even though I don't know what it looks like, it's still not this. This isn't it. Okay, so here's a few iterations of that one delusion, which you may recognize or not, but see how they might resonate with your own experience. I don't get it. I'll never get it. Just when I think I understand and am getting somewhere, it slips away and I lose it again. My blank is a problem, an obstacle. That blank could be anger, pride, stupidity, habits, any number of things. You get to fill it in yourself multiple times, I'm sure. After I deal with my blank, then I'll be able to blank. It shouldn't be this hard. It couldn't be this easy. So-and-so has something I don't, so it's easier for her. Once I have blank, then I'll start to get it. My personal circumstances keep me from making any real progress. I have too many issues, hang-ups, etc., and not enough time for awakening. In order to blank, I have to get rid of blank. I need to have blank before I can blank. Or I simply don't have what it takes. So you might take some time to sit down and write down your iterations of that one delusion, this isn't it. And just see, you know, what comes up, and then notice, spelunk down into the cave of those manifestations and delusions and see if you find at the core that one delusion. Maybe you'll find something else. But it seems worthwhile to just notice, how many ways does this manifest in my life, in my thoughts, in my habits, in my actions? that seems to be one way of working with these and becoming aware of them, is actually to name them and put them out there. But then there's that bigger question of how then do we work with this? If we identify this as the one delusion, what do we do about it? How do we work with it? And this analogy, it came up years ago. You know, this happens a lot where I used to work as a social worker or mental health worker with kids and things, and I'd have these, of course, never on the job, or rarely on the job, but afterwards have this great analogy to use. And I'm waiting for the moment to be able to use it, and that comes sometimes never happens. But then this analogy that I've been holding on for some time came up in relation to this, and I was like, was that because of what I did as my work, or was it something I wanted to do because of my practice? I can't remember. And maybe it doesn't matter. I think it's woven into both. But the analogy was just to see ourselves, our lives, as a river. And to look at... As a river, we have an original source from which we come. And in our teachings, in our tradition, we are told from the very beginning we are Buddhas, we are awakened. That is our original source. Yet when we hear that and we look at our lives, we might say, what are you talking about? I don't experience that. I don't feel that. And that's because at some point that river has become polluted upstream. And to me, that's the big barrel of the delusion. This isn't it, tipping over and pouring into the river and polluting all the waters from that moment on. So it's the same river, the same water flowing, one source from the origin and another source somewhere along the way that contaminated it, changed our relationship to it and our feeling of it. And then at some point in our lives, we begin to awaken to the polluted nature of our river, so to speak. And it could just be that feeling of discomfort or disconnection from something we've known. Or we feel intimate to it, but we can't quite capture it and reconnect with it. So there's that discomfort in waking up to, like you said, the pollution, the contamination. And our normal way of dealing with that is to work with whatever we have downstream. We might channel the water this way, build a dam and hold it back over here, break it out into smaller portions, redirect it, things like that. But all we're doing is redirecting polluted water. So no matter how efficient we can make that, our channels and the source, or the flow of it, how efficient and beneficial we might make it, irrigating and feeding things around it, it's still the polluted water. So that's the invitation to look at, how did the water get polluted? How did that happen in the first place? And we come, maybe, if your investigation shows, it's that one thing that I think it always isn't it, whatever I'm experiencing. That's what's polluted this river. And this is where things start to get tricky. Because sometimes, you know, we feel, when we can find the source of something, we address it. And this can sometimes be true in the real world. You find the source, you address it by doing maybe the opposite or patching up what was broken, and it functions well. But if we try to take that approach here, we end up with another delusion. Because as I see, the antidote to this isn't it is to say this is it, which sounds good. But it's still a belief. If we just go around saying all the time, this is it, and just believe in it, it's the same thing as believing this isn't it. Because whatever we believe, if it is a filter between our direct experience by which we're judging it and categorizing it, then we're not as directly connected with what we're experiencing. And it may be good for a while to carry around, this is it, to start doing that, to reverse the other habit. But essentially, there's a root source of both of those beliefs or thinkings, which is what I found in the Isaiah and Gates, and that source is taking up a position about anything. So Joan Sutherland brings in our ancestors, Great Master Ma and Shitto, and talks about the radical thing they were doing in their time. So neither Ma nor Shitto allowed questioners to remain for a moment in the position of someone who doesn't get it. But they weren't interested in replacing that position with a better one. I didn't used to get it, but now I do. Their project was more radical. What's it like to have no position at all? Shitto would challenge his questioner's self-doubt, which is often the unacknowledged basis of a position. Someone asked Shitto, "What am I supposed to do? Why are you asking me? Where else can I find what I'm looking for? Are you sure you lost it?" So taking up a position with anything, saying this isn't it, this is it, as I was proposing, keeps us a little bit distant from our experience itself. And again, maybe helpful for a while to undo the old habit patterns, but in the end, it can't be a lasting project as I see it. It becomes another project of self-improvement and self-redirection. In the manner of all the little streams and creeks, but here in the bigger section, we're still just redirecting the water. So this is where it gets even more interesting for me, because the way that we work with that original source that's polluting is by working with all the manifestations out there, all the different channels and creeks and streams of things. And there's like this mutuality happening. When we work and meet with what we meet, not as seeking and trying to find, is this it, is this it, is this it, or filtering out, this isn't it, this isn't it. Not taking the position, just meeting it. But noticing, yeah, this is painful. This brings joy. This does nothing. But not having the added on is or isn't quality to it. The water underneath the water, the Rio Abajo Rio as we speak, flows the other way. It goes back to the source and begins to bring what we discover to the source. It's like those moments when we're in something that's always been a hindrance. But it lights up, it changes for us, something happens. There's a flash of energy there that shoots upstream and starts to clean out what's been happening. And that just goes on in our practice. We're always feeding that stream. So in essence, the stream might just be cycling around, becoming more and more the original stream that it is, without having to get rid of that pollution. But that's another delusion. We have to get rid of that, because this isn't it. And it's what we talk of a lot, of simply being with what is. Directly. And there are times when there might be, what came to mind for me was one of our poems from Mary Oliver in our end of the day readings, where she just says, using the metaphor of a tree, that all of the locks click open at once, and fire surges through the tree and the blossoms bloom. So you work on that one lock, that one channel in the river. Something happens and all of a sudden all the channels are opened. The pollution is gone. Everything surges. The original river surging as it has been and is all along. So then I was thinking about all of our koan stories. And how all of them are examples of people tending their rivers. Yeah. We have these stories. We might get, okay, this is just one little instance of working with one creek in this person's river. Or sometimes we have a longer story. We get to, or take up the record of somebody. We get to see the course of their life as they took up again and again the matter of their river. And the moments we usually hear about are those things lighting up and the river being charged with the energy of, ah. Yeah? Connecting with the original source, the original flow. But there's also something in our koans that thanks to, this has happened in the last few talks, so it's nice, and so to give gratitude to the PZI, the Pacific Zen Institute's email list that I'm on. You know, the last few times somebody's provided a poem that I've brought in that seemed to fit with the talk, and either one that they wrote or from somebody out in the world. And this time, just a couple days ago, somebody was writing a post and said, there's this one koan that says something about this, and it really reminds me of whatever he was writing about. When I looked at that, I was like, oh, great, there's a koan right there that seems to really work well with this one delusion and this territory that I had been exploring. So there's that side of it, but there also, in the exchange, I was shown kind of the hindrances in the koans themselves because of, well, for one thing, they use other people's names. And so sometimes if we're reading a story about somebody else, we can trigger, that's not me. This isn't it. There's a delusion again. So we always encourage ourselves and one another, take up these stories. Don't worry about the names. Take them up as your own experience because they are your own experience. But still, that's an inherent obstacle that just triggers something in us to read about somebody else's thing and just automatically say, that can't happen to me. That can't be me. And then the other side of it is jargon in our tradition and in koan, sometimes the big E word, enlightenment, you know, triggers that idea of, that's it. What is it? Do I have an idea of what enlightenment is or not? Is it accessible to me or not? I notice for myself with the jargon kind of things, my eyes gloss over when I hit those words. And it has done that for years, from the very beginning, I think. I think part of it was a defense mechanism, you know, to keep myself from connecting with it and trying to figure out what it is. Yeah? But I also realized, well, that kind of keeps me from exploring it and unraveling it and maybe making it more intimate. That's something that came out of this exchange. So while the koan story, which I'll share with you in a moment, seems to me to walk right through this territory pretty well, what happened alongside it was the person who sent out the post, there's a few exchanges, then he said, I don't know the koan completely. Does anybody out there know what it is? And it's one koan for which I have particular affection, so I was like, oh, great, I'll look it up. And I found, you know, a copy of it and sent it out the traditional form. Well, not maybe not traditional, but in Entangling Vines, one of our collections. Sent it along, and it had the names of the characters, and it had enlightenment listed in the jargon. And the person was grateful. Then John Tarrant shared his version that he uses in the koan salons. And he took out the names and did something different with the jargon. And when I read that, I just felt that, ah, this makes it accessible and intimate. And it made me realize, yeah, I know these things. I recognize this. This is possible in my life. So I'll read that and kind of point out where it is in this territory I've been walking. And see how it is for you. A poet was visiting a friend who was a Zen teacher. And as they were talking, the poet asked, what is Zen anyway? The friend said, well, you know, there's a classic saying which goes, my friends, do you think I'm hiding something from you? Actually, I'm hiding nothing from you. Zen is like that. I don't get it, said the poet, and they left it there. So to me, that phrase is the expression of the original source, the teachings that say, from the beginning, you're awakened, you're enlightened, you have it already. And our response is, yeah, right, I don't get it. So that's the territory here in the koan from the working with that river. The next day, the two of them were walking in the hills, and the air was filled with the fragrance of sweet olive blossoms. Can you smell the scent of the sweet olive blossoms? Asked the teacher. Yes, why, yes I can, said the poet. You see, I'm hiding nothing from you, said the teacher. The poet's heart and mind opened. She wept and was filled with joy. That's that realization, maybe, of the original source of pollution that begins to turn us towards, oh, it is it. It is all it. That scent of the blossom permeates the air. Everywhere I walk in my life, everything I encounter, that's it. So that's that flash that maybe feels like it's going to last and permeate and be there for a long time. In the original, instead of saying she wept and was filled with joy, it says the person was enlightened. I know what it's like to weep. I know what it's like to experience joy. Yeah. That's intimate to my experience. Enlightenment, not so much. I have no idea what that is. So then it goes on. Later, she visited another friend who was also a Zen teacher. They were sitting and drinking tea in the afternoon when the conversation took a turn and the teacher said, well, in the end, I'll die and you'll die and we'll be two heaps of ashes. Then, where will we meet? So, the poet tried to speak, but no words came. She couldn't move her tongue. She couldn't remember the question. And that's that moment of, I thought I got that barrel of pollution out of the stream. Yet, what's happening here? It's not quite fixing everything. What am I supposed to do? And maybe it brings us back in that territory of, here it is again, the stuff I thought I was over, I must work with, I must work with. And maybe it loosens up the idea of, before I didn't get it, then I got it. Takes us to that place of maybe not trying to get or not get, just being with what is, which seems to be the character of the last section of the story. Later, she was traveling again with a party of friends, and during a warm afternoon, she took a nap. When she woke up, she understood what her friend had meant. In the original, it says, thereafter, it was a he, not a she, but thereafter, she attained the samadhi of perfect freedom. Sounds pretty big and unreachable, unattainable again to me. John Terence's version is, after that, she was pretty much happy. And I know that. I know what it is to be happy. And so that lights up for me in my life. I think we all know what it is to be happy, to feel joy. We also know what it is to not get it, and to get it, and to lose it. But that pretty much happy, now after that, she's pretty much happy all the time. Regardless of circumstances, I might add. Or that unconditional happiness, which just rises to meet us, and the gratitude and joy that comes from who knows where. Despite our better efforts, it shows up. Despite what we tell ourselves about it not being able to show up, there it is. Meeting us, welcoming us, and inviting us. Wordlessly. It's not saying, this is it. It's just saying, ah. Or maybe we are saying, ah, together we may meet. Yeah, every time. All right, thanks.